Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I'm Monique Anton, your host, and today on the show, I have Mark English. How are you, Mark?
I'm well, Monique. I'm glad to be here.
Mark is the principal of Mark English Architects in San Francisco. He earned his Bachelor's of Architecture at Cal Poly and a Master's of Architecture at Syracuse University. After that, he founded his firm in 1992. He's won countless awards and also edits an online magazine called The Architect's Take, which we're going to get into in a second. But can you share with us about your beginnings in this architecture world? I was fascinated to learn that it wasn't modernism that caught your eye. It was something else. Why don't we start there?
Thank you. Yeah, I was lucky enough as a very young person, really I think it was 7 or 8 years old. My parents are from upstate New York originally. My father was stationed in Colorado in the Air Force. So he had fallen in love before my parents got together. He'd really fallen in love with the West. And so from the time I was 8 years old till probably 13 or 14, we would drive across country every summer. And, you know, I think we spent more time in the Southwest than anywhere else. He'd sort of slow down going through Arizona, Utah, New Mexico, Wyoming, etc. And I really fell in love as a young person with both the landscape, because it's a landscape that's more understandable in a way. There are fewer trees, there are fewer buildings. Mm. It's sort of an unwrapped landscape. And but on top of that, or in addition to that, I especially became attracted to the Pueblo architecture that we came across, both in places like Taos, where people are still living in these pueblos, but also in ruins like Chaco Canyon and the Hopi area and so on, I became fascinated with those buildings. Those are mass buildings, right? They're not made of wood. They're stone and mud. And that really got me excited about, well, I thought I wanted to be a geologist, but then I became more excited about the human beings interacting with the terrain,
right.
And that led to other interests, which really started with National Geographic too. I started getting excited about Inca architecture. I still remember the cover on that magazine back all those years ago, and Mayan architecture and so on.
Yes, I would say that's a lot of spiritual architecture and something that is incredibly difficult to duplicate. Incredibly,
it is. Anything resembling architecture started really when I saw in a magazine, and I was about 12, a building in Uxmal, which is down in Yucatan, a Mayan building. It was a very, very long building, long, narrow, rectangular sort of building, kind of modern feeling. And I tried to replicate it on paper. You know, I was looking at a picture and I realized I had that aha moment that all those lines converge at one point on a horizon line. So I was drawing this. And I thought, that's amazing. I didn't realize that. So I became interested in drawing architecture, even as a young person, you know, studying books and magazines and so on. Mm.
So. I've been researching your blog and your work on The Architect's Take. And I just have to tell you, I really respect and was inspired by how much you care about that community, the articles that you wrote, you and people that you had hired to work on it, the interviews that you have on there. It was just so insightful, and I was amazed at how much you care about this community and wanted to share the information with others. Can you share with us about how that blog came about?
That blog came about at a slow time back in 2010. where for a short period of time, architects, including me, spent a lot more time socializing with designers and going to parties and so forth because we didn't really have a lot of work. But I noticed two things at that time. Number one, I didn't really understand what most other architects cared about or what they were doing because we don't talk all that much. And secondly, I didn't find interviews that told me anything about what those architects thought about. I couldn't find anything that wasn't sort of a canned analysis of someone's work or, you know, a list of schools they went to or the famous architects they knew and so on. So I happened to be the building architect on a showcase house up in San Francisco, and a whole bunch of designers were invited to do the various rooms, which is common. There were great parties because of that. The designers knew how to party. One of the rooms was very strange, and it was by a firm called Min Day. E.B. Min and Jeff Day at the time had a firm together. And it wasn't like the other rooms. It had strange, parametrically penetrated colored walls, brightly colored, like the bathroom was all one color, the tile, the floor, the countertop, everything was like a shocking pink. And they had a green room. And I thought, you know, do I have the guts to go talk to EB and figure out why they're doing this and how they're doing this? They were doing CNC. And then I looked them up a little bit. And I saw some of their work. I thought, I don't understand this at all. So I asked EB, I think at the opening party, I said, EB, I would love to find out what it is you're doing, why, and how you got here.
Right.
Like, how did you actually decide you were going to be an architect? And her path, as I found out later, was very different. It was history and then landscape architecture, then architecture. That led to, and I happened to have someone named Rebecca working with me who had worked for Bernardo Urqueta, who's a great architect from Chile, but she'd been like an office manager, and I found out she could write really well. So we decided together to start this blog. And our first article was about E.B. Min and Jeff Day and about what parametric architecture is. And we got into the weeds about Rhino and all the software they were using and the history of why they became architects. And that led to a lot of interviews right off the bat, and nobody ever said no. We've done close to several hundred articles at this point. A lot of those are interviews. And then we'd interview a bunch of architects, local, that would lead to interviews with stonemasons, and that would lead to interviews with lighting designers and other associated people that we became curious about. And no one ever said no, and we learned a lot about our peers and friends and so on. That exercise actually really helped a lot of those architects. If you, for instance, do a search on Ole Lundberg or do a Google search on Jim Zak, you'll find our article, which is by now 10 years old. It will pop up on the first page. It's amazing to me. I used to do a lot of lecturing around social media. I was definitely sold from the beginning on the viral tendencies of social media articles to spread and so on. I got it right away. New media versus old media. I have a whole slideshow about that. And it really does work.
It really does.
I knew it worked, and it worked for us, and it worked for them. So I'm very excited about the AI revolution, and I have some ideas about who to talk to about that.
That's good. For those of you listening, you can go to the Architects Take thearchitectstake.com to read those articles that Mark is talking about. So I want to switch gears and talk a little bit about the awards. I've lost track of how many awards you have won over the years, but there's 30 that I was going down the list, some of which are AIA, SF, the Design Awards that you won in this year, 2024, DNA Paris Design Award, 2024. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you how you have the energy, the stamina to keep doing this. I don't know how you won all of these awards this year. It seems exhausting to me. But how do you keep up this stamina for this?
There's almost two questions in that question. I think the first question is, it goes back to a very fundamental characteristic of architects, I think. You either have the calling or you don't. And I have the calling. This is not a job. Mm-hmm. It's not a quote-unquote profession. It's something that sort of grabbed me in the beginning. I had my first house built when I was 19. It's still there, unfortunately. I keep checking Google Earth, and there it is. It's, you know, taller than everything else, and it's what you'd expect from a 19-year-old boy. But I've had that hunger, and I know that a lot of the people around me who are my age and some younger have that sense of calling. So right off the bat, I think that there is an aspect of one's life story, you know, to complete this, to do as much as possible with the time that we have.
Absolutely. So let's talk about some of your projects. I want to start with the Atherton design mm-hmm. first. To me, this is such an exciting design. It's such an exciting house. The use of the glazing in the front with the focal point being the one dominant area of those vertical wood lines. Mm-hmm. It's really amazing. I was speechless looking at the interiors there also. Can you share with us a little bit about the process there?
That was a very interesting and kind of a different project for us. We tend to be very activated by topography, terrain, views, long distance views, even what the sun is doing at different times of year or where the moon rises on somebody's birthday, all of those other esoteric things that are out there. This is on a 1-acre lot in Atherton that's basically inward looking. Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to outward looking. There are very few views off site. So the idea was to really create a lot of drama within the house and between the inside part of the house and the outside part of the house, you know, the yes. indoor-outdoor side. So we also were very lucky to have clients who had built before. They had built in Singapore, they had built in Hong Kong.
Wow.
And they because they were not, and this was a little while ago, so there was still not that much modern residential architecture happening. They didn't have the prejudice about modern architecture. They weren't worried about it. They weren't put off. They had had two other white houses that were very modern, and they were very happy to have another one in California. Mm-hmm. Very different. You know, they talked about the Hong Kong house, 7 stories high, but only, you know, a footprint of 1,500 square feet. That's wow. an aspect of the topography of Hong Kong and the development possibilities. Here we had an acre, and so we sort of spread out into that acre and created drama. We spent a lot of time, and my client Nancy was very much on board with this, is how do we make the journey through the house exciting?
Yeah.
So we had done a previous project where we had an internal bridge between two wings of a home. Very modest, actually, a short little bridge. But this was an opportunity to really go for it. So this bridge is quite a bridge. And we explored lots of stair ideas. We did lots of physical models. We did lots of 3D modeling program studies. But the activating, it's not a spiral stair, but sort of a helical stair, the energy of that movement, moving up and down and then across the bridge, really turned out to be the right thing as we studied it.
Yes.
As a family, they also believe in feng shui, so they had this whole other, they weren't all that open about it first, but as it turns out, the sweeping stair does something really good with the chi energy.
Okay.
within the house. So that was nice to know.
Yeah, that was a plus.
Yes. That also influenced that the whole front facade, which is the east-facing facade, with everything is white except for that facade. That facade is actually Corten steel hung on the building. Mm-hmm. And it's a two-story high section. And it's meant to work in conjunction with an olive tree that we planted. The two work together. It's a yin-yang. It's the tree that's beating entropy, and it's the rusting metal facade that is slowly drifting towards entropy. So that was the poetic side of what happened at the entrance of the house. It was an amazing, like most really great projects, there was little wasted energy on, let me put it a different way, our clients were fearless.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Being a purist, I think my favorite house that you've done is the Meadow House in Carmel Valley.
Me too.
And it's yours. And I was very, very impressed with the delicate vertical lines of the wood. Again, these vertical lines that you do, it's the house almost seems invisible to me. Mm-hmm. I think when you look at it from the front. Mm-hmm. And it sort of disappears in the landscape, which I think is brilliant. There's also a sunken living room that is really beautiful. You all can see what I'm talking about on his website. It's markenglisharchitects.com. This is such a pure, bold room with just that edge of the floor-to-ceiling glass that's really impressive. What was the process like on that site? Because it looks like it might have been a difficult site.
The Meadow House is my favorite house. I would say that it's the least encumbered by any kind of misunderstanding or difference of opinion. I worked with a family that said to me, "I want to." We're from Korea originally, but we want a house that's like a Korean house, which is in Korea they're called hanok. They're sort of compound houses. Lots of personal and public business happens in a hanok, just like in an ancient Roman house. And so we want to have a house that can accommodate family life, but also public life. And now I didn't know this at first. We got well through design, and I'll talk a little bit about the process. But I said, you know, Eleanor, I'm just amazed that you had so much faith in us, because this house doesn't look like any other house that you've seen, and it doesn't look like the homes that you shared with us in your lookbooks and so forth. And she said, "Oh, I went to RISD in architecture. I knew what you were doing." So she kept that in her pocket the whole time.
Wow.
I had no idea.
Amazing.
I had no idea. But it was it's a very special place. The preserve, the Santa Lucia Preserve, Carmel Valley, 22,000 acres of preserve with 300 building sites that were planned for very carefully. By Hart Howerton was the planning and architecture firm that actually even determined where our houses could go. So the very thoughtful process. The design review board is all design professionals. There are no politicians, there are no planners who used to be literature majors who decided to go into planning. It's nothing like that. There's a landscape architect, a builder, architect, a planner, you know, a real planner, mm-hmm. etc. So their concern is about doing great architecture and not about, you know, some bureaucratic letter of the law thing.
That's great.
Yeah. And that site, on the other hand, was near the Hacienda, which is sort of the HQ. It's the old ranch house there. And so the particular site, the homeland that we were building on, was pretty sensitive because it's visible from the Hacienda, which is sort of the headquarters of the preserve. So the design review board is extremely vigilant about what we were doing. And we worked very carefully. We created a complete 3D model of all the trees and the topography, as well as a physical model, and worked openly with them on the design of the house. So that's, as the house, you know, developed, its form really started to express a desire to not focus towards the hacienda, as well as focus on all the other elements that we were trying to include. The original plan for that homeland suggested that a home should be built right in the middle of the meadow. And we were totally against that. I mean, it was exactly the wrong thing to do. And we said so, and there was some pushback. But eventually we decided that the home should be split into pieces. So there's sort of a, on one side of the meadow, which we preserved, altered with Arterra landscape architects, we pushed the garage and the guest house to one side, and then pushed the bulk of the house against a really heroic stand of live oaks, and kind of bent the house around that stand, and then created a barrier to the other house, which was fairly near us. We sort of turned our back on that, presented a facade that had high windows, but those windows were so high there was no issue with you know, any kind of privacy or anything like that. So all of this was modeled, and we created physical models, and finally were able to convince the DRB that in fact it would disappear more or less into the landscape. And we have quite a bit of glass on that project.
A ton of glass.
Yes. But we have wood screens that we worked with to create both privacy and also for sun control. The way that the screens work, there are lots of wood screens out there, obviously. Everyone's using them. In our case, we pulled them to the edge of very, very, very extensive overhangs. In some cases, they're 16 feet. So the purpose for that was to create a real indoor-outdoor experience. And when we were actually photographing the house last year, Joe Fletcher and some of my staff actually stayed in the house for 3 days. And we opened up all the glass walls, pushed all the doors back, you know, at night when we were done shooting, and just sort of hung out. And it really did feel that way. You could see the deer walking through.
Oh,
you know,
great.
They'd come in and sort of look at us. The turkeys were there. It worked tremendously well. And
beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, for those of you listening, there is still construction going on next door. And I apologize that we've had to stop shooting and recordings for a while because of construction, but it looks like they're still at it, but we can edit some of that out. So, which brings me to your next design, the Toro House.
Yes.
In Woodside.
Yes.
This was also done in 2017 and is such a glowing gem of a house. It feels like it's this zen-like tree house that just is such a beautiful indoor-outdoor space. Can you share with us about that design and how you did the lighting in that house?
That started as it was an L-shaped mid-century home that that had a lot going for it. We loved it, and we wanted to keep it. And I had had the structural engineer come over to look at it, and he took one look. He had a great eye. He said, "You understand the roof sagging about 6 inches from that end to that end."
Oh, no.
And it's not just the roof. The floor has also moved. So the whole thing has moved. So you're not going to be able to keep it. You're not going to be able to restore this building. What we did is we built that L back. You know, we built a new building there following the same footprint, which is what was allowed in that jurisdiction. But then added a third element, which was the tallest element, which contained the main dining, the more ceremonial space, dining space, library space for our client, who was a designer and had worked at Apple and in the Valley at various places. The scheme of the house is very simple. It's an L, but we didn't extend that L. We created a separate element that's then linked with a L-shaped path between the two pieces, so that they almost feel like you're walking into a little canyon, a cleft in between, in between two building pieces. Mm-hmm. Everything is wrapped with cedar wood that's beautifully kept. So it's an extremely warm feeling. The lighting is meant to, which is, it's given away in the name of the house, the way we've named it, Toro, which is Japanese for a type of lantern. It really lights up at night because it's a small house. It's set up on a little knoll. There's a pool down below. And when one approaches the house, we really wanted this feeling of being beckoned into like a cottage, like you've taken a trip through the forest. There are redwoods there. It's dark. And all of a sudden you see this glowing lantern.
Amazing.
And it was, we had a great client there who respected design greatly and had suggestions, had expectations, but really let us do what we needed to do. And I think it turned out very well. We're very happy with it.
That's beautiful. I love that sustainability. I love that you've kept that original footprint. Mm-hmm. You've quoted one of our friends and colleagues, John Klopp, who has also been on this podcast. And you quoted him on one of your websites saying, "Sustainability is not a part of architecture. Architecture is a part of sustainability." And that architects have the responsibility for making the built environment as healthy and as sustainable as possible. Mm-hmm. Can you share with us your vision about that and what people can do to attain that?
Yeah, I had a professor a long time ago in college the first time say to me, it takes just as much effort to make a bad building as it does to make a good building. And the cornerstone of sustainability, number one, is to design a building that has the integrity that leads people to want to keep it and not tear it down. Now, a building that's sustainable is a building that doesn't get torn down because it's designed poorly. And that could mean that it's designed poorly from just a comfort point of view, and that has a lot to do with paying attention to where the sun is and paying attention to where the wind, the breezes are, etc. And obviously, John is absolutely right. People do care about design, even if they don't know it, and they will keep beautiful buildings intact. And that, to me, is the most important part of sustainability. I think that we have a lot to learn from so-called ancient people, or people in other parts of the world who don't have technology, because they would never be silly enough to have the big overhang on a roof on the north side, unless it's South America, on the north side and not on the south side. But we see this all over in our country where people don't pay any attention to orientation and then wonder why that particular house is miserable or that building is miserable. So I think a lot of this is common sense, but we often have trouble finding common sense.
Mm-hmm. Which buildings have been most unforgettable for you in person? You've designed a lot of buildings as well, but mm-hmm. I wonder which one stands out in your mind.
I think for me, there's no comparison with, and this is a big surprise, it's been about 10 years I was in France. I always wanted to see Ronchamp, the chapel at Ronchamp, and that was great. But it was really La Tourette by Corbusier. Blew my mind. I think about it probably a couple times a week still. I think it's such a masterful, amazing, transformational building that I just didn't anticipate that there would be a building like that anywhere. And I've been all over the world. Mm-hmm. I think that the way that Corbusier leads you through a path that delights and awes and frightens you along the way until you end up in the little cubicles where the monks stay. It's an astonishing journey. And the work that he does with color is unparalleled. The intention is so clear to me, and that is really what architecture is about, is intention. The intention that allows people long after you're dead to understand maybe what you were thinking when you designed the house, that is, I think, the magic of architecture.
beautiful. And I wanted to ask you, we had talked a little bit about the differences between mid-century modern architecture and modern architecture. What is your take on that?
I think a lot of mid-century architecture, especially that I see in California, is obviously derived from these incredible Europeans that came over either before, you know, between wars or after World War II. Schindler, Neutra, and others who came and, you know, were maybe less successful in their homelands, came to America and found incredible resources and were also unfettered a little bit from their academic backgrounds. So they could really run. And right. And those homes, and there are some great examples, obviously, Albert Frey and Neutra down in
Palm Springs,
incredible work that then inspired a second and third and fourth generation of other architects, many of whom are very good. And I think in general, mid-century architecture is derivative from that architecture. And in my personal opinion, it's at least neutral. It's rarely the case that a mid-century home is a negative experience. Can't say that for a lot of, you know, Victorian buildings. I wouldn't say that about all the fake Spanish houses that are out there. But I think the emphasis even on those derivative mid-century homes is really on the connection between inside and outside. So I think in that way they are they're successful.
You have a lot of great relationships with a lot of our friends in architecture, like Jim Jennings, mm-hmm. like Bob Swat, who was also on the podcast. And you mentioned that you have talked with them about these risks that you're taking. You all take such huge risks all the time. How do you help each other through this? You mentioned you've reached out or you've had different conversations about a strategy.
It's an interesting profession because we don't talk that much. I'm in a building right now with Ross Levy and Michael Hennessy, both great architects, and you know, we hardly even talk, and we're in the same building. So it takes an effort, and I think we actually in San Francisco have an incredible email chain with small architects. We have about 200 architects that share every day, probably 30, 40 times a day, all kinds of questions about design, practice. We can't do this in person somehow, but we can do it through email, and it works really, really well. So that's the way that we help each other, those of us who stay. And we're really talking about business owners, not really employees so much, mm-hmm. people that who have a calling and who've really made the decision that they're all in.
Right. I love that. I feel that way about my business too. There is no out. There is no, you know, exit strategy. There is no thinking that you're going to do something else. It's just, you know, just like this podcast. It's so much fun. I can't, you know, I think about it, and when you think about it that much, you have to do it.
Yes.
If you were not an architect, what would you do?
I would. I love gardening. I love productive gardening. I have a great garden in Napa. I can tomatoes. I plant, my wife and I both, you know, tend to flower garden. I would do that. It's the most peaceful, satisfying exercise I've ever been through. Things where you put things in the ground and they grow. Sometimes they die and you replace them and then something else grows. They change every day. And that really... That came alive for me during the pandemic because I was, you know, locked up there for a while, and I got to do a lot of work outside. I created all kinds of gardens and still managed to stay in business. Mm-hmm. So I think I'd be doing that. I think that, and probably will do that at some point. I'm doing it now when I can.
Yes.
So I think that's where I would end up.
One of these conversations we had was about how long do you anticipate doing this work? And I can't see you not doing this work, Mark.
You know, I think people that do have the calling don't see this as a job. It's not even really a profession. It's a It's a calling. It's part of your DNA. And I think most of us who have that passion will keep doing it to the end. I've also found the benefit of having resilience and having drive is that good things come sometimes after a long time. I mean, I've been in business 30 years, and I would say that only now are we really getting good at what we're doing. You know, this is why the awards are coming. This is why the kind of work that we're doing in the preserve is coming to us, because we actually, it's taken 30 years to learn how to do it well. You know, so I'm not about to quit at this point. I think I have another 15 years of high-level work. And then after that, I'll do what my friend Jim Jennings has done and keep doing it, but just slow down a little bit and get some help. And that's right. He's sort of my architectural hero. He's the one that I'd like to emulate.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, we are very excited to see what you do in the next 30 years. And I can't thank you enough for finding the time after we've coordinated for a month to get this on record. So thank you so much, Mark, and thank you for your amazing work.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.